Hello, I'm Paddy O'Donoghue, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 7 of the In The Bin Rugby Pod. It's been a scintillating week of rugby from Cape Town to Exeter, but to kick things off this week, we'll be taking 10 minutes out for an HIA to discuss the mounting injury crisis in the Aviva Premiership and whether there'll be any players left for next week's games. In the Premiership's weekend games, Jamie George gets hooked on tries as Sarries dismiss Wasps, Gloucester continue to ruin our predictions by giving the Saints hell, and Exeter bring the Falcons back down to earth at Sandy Park. The glut of bonus points to the Pro 14 dried up slightly, but the excitement didn't, as Glasgow bit back for the race of men by becoming the first team to win away at the Cheetahs in a barnstormer of a game. Leinster edged out Munster in the big derby game of the weekend, and the Kings continue to play like peasants as they are trounced by Benetton Treviso. In the Southern Hemisphere, New Zealand conclude their second consecutive unbeaten rugby championship, but with a much closer than predicted victory over South Africa. And finally, Champions Cup rugby is back. We'll preview the opening fixtures, including games between sides that finished 5th and 10th in their respective leagues last year. Makes sense given the name of the competition, doesn't it? Right, Andy, hello, how are you?
I'm all right, Paddy, how are you going? Yeah, not too bad at all.
Yeah, slightly later pod than usual this week, but I'm going to blame you for that, really, because you made me feel very bad on Sunday and Monday after visiting me on Saturday.
I was not the one that opened the third bottle of red wine, so I'm going to leave that on your shoulders.
I'm going to say it was in honour of the French and the fact that Champions Cup was coming back next weekend that I thought it'd have been rude not to.
Any excuse, really. You know me.
Yeah, it's fair enough. Right, so big kind of news story, not necessarily of this week, but something that's been kind of hitting the headlines for the last few weeks, really, is the injuries, particularly in the Premiership, but smatterings of it, I think, in the Pro 14 as well. And really just the sheer number of injuries that are going, that are happening at the moment. And it just seems to be a sharp increase on previous seasons. Very, very noticeable. So I know that we've both been looking at some of the figures and the stats behind this, in particular, a few articles written by Andy McGeady, an Irish journalist who seems to have been spending a lot of time poring over this kind of stuff. And there seems to be a theory that there's a correlation between the increase in time that the ball is in play and then subsequently the increased number of collisions, which includes tackles and rucks as well.
Yeah, he's done a lot of stuff with the Opta data. And when you read his article, he does make it very clear that he's not drawing any conclusions. He's just giving you figures and numbers. But it does seem that the numbers do back up what's going on. And especially, like you say, with the ball in play time in the Premiership, it's up almost sort of 6 or 7 minutes from 2013-14. And then the number of tackles is up almost 70 per game in that time. And tackle attempts are up about 80. Number of rucks are up. And actually, looking at some of the injuries that occur, I mean, you only have to look at Jack Clifford's this weekend. It's not necessarily the tackles, it's in the ruck. When you're sort of set at a ruck, sort of over the top, and one of the opposition can come and hit you, so you've already made it to the ruck and you're sort of trying to secure the ball, and they get a run up and they hit you, and your arms are down and they hit your shoulders, they hit your head. You see a lot of people going off with dislocated shoulders, or they roll back over their legs and people fall onto their legs and their legs are hyperextended. So it's all things like that. And like you say, it's got to be something in there in terms of the fact there are more times that you get hit, whether it's a ruck or a tackle, that you're going to get more injuries. It just seems an obvious correlation to make.
Yeah, and I think that's why we're seeing an increase in the use of the term collisions, because that will encompass both tackles and the ruck area. And I think given the ferocity of the breakdown as well, it seems almost inevitable, and there's been a few law tweaks, haven't there, which have tried to encourage this extra time of the ball in play. And as collisions account for 70% of all injuries, it does seem to make a lot of sense that it's kind of a natural progression, that if you're going to encourage more collisions, you're going to get more injuries. I think what's potentially interesting, though, is that it does seem to be the Premiership that's been hit harder. There's a bit of an anomaly, because I think Dragons have just had the most horrific run out of anybody. They had a couple of late withdrawals before the Cardiff game, which took them up to 29 unavailable players, which, you know, considering that's more than a match day squad, that's pretty incredible. But on the whole, it does seem that Premiership teams have been worse affected. And I just wonder if just, and then this is, I don't know if there's any weight behind this, but it's just from me viewing games in both competitions. I see what I perceive to be a lot more physical, brutal games in the Premiership than I do in the Pro 14. And I don't know if that's just a mentality or the fact that there's a more even spread of quality and more evenly matched teams that you get that. And I'm not sure if there's something a little bit in that as well.
I mean, I spoke about this last week, having watched a bit more Pro 14 this season than I had before, that I thought they did play a bit of a wider game. And you don't get that same ferocity of collision when you go wide. You know, an outside centre making a break around the other outside centre, it tends to be a low tackle into the sort of stomach or the hips to bring him down. Whereas if you're a hooker or a, you know, back row forward running off a ball from 9 or 10 into other back row players, you get smashed. You know, it's a proper full on, you know, man on man hit. And there's something in that. And equally, I think if you bring the top 14 stats into it from France, they have less ball in play time. Their ball in play time is 6 minutes less. And I don't know if it's because in the Premiership, although we're focused on big players, it seems to have gone almost to big players who are super fit. And if you look at the way Exeter play and Saracens play, it's a lot about trying to get lots of phases together, good continuity, and then go wide. Whereas I think sometimes you watch the French teams play and it's not even about trying to go wide. It's just about trying to be the biggest team on the pitch and just go forward, 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 forward. And so actually the ball perhaps isn't in play as much because there's more knock-ons, there's more scrums, there's more line out. And so they don't get as many hits. And I think the Premiership's sort of a tale of both, if you like. They've got big, fit players now who can keep the ball in play longer, increasing hits. And it's just a sort of bringing together of everything is causing more injuries.
Yeah, I think I'm going to call that the Bastereau syndrome in France, where they're just renowned for their talent and their pace and their trickery and flair. But it seems like that was a bit of a landmark moment when, you know, pivotal moment when things changed, when they had Bastereau in the centres, because that is very much give you the ball and run into someone. I think one interesting point to make on this just before we move on is that obviously with data, the more you have and the longer period of time it's taken over, only then can you properly start to draw conclusions. And we are only, what, 6 games into the season. And it could be that the next 6 weeks are actually relatively injury free. And this is just a bit of a bizarre turn of events. But a lot of people have attributed some of this to the changes in rules. But the Pro 14 actually has this season, tackles are down in terms of average tackles per game. Rucks are down and ball in play time is also down. And that then seems to kind of contradict the popular theory of the rule changes have driven the increased collisions, which have driven the injuries, which does seem very strange.
Yeah, but, you know, people always like a popular theory. People like to be able to put their hat on a bandwagon and go with it. You know, so they've looked at all these injuries and people like a reason for something. They don't want to just say, oh, it could just be coincidence. People are scared of coincidence usually. So they've gone, well, it must be because of the law changes. And you don't actually get the figures on the type of injury until about 3 or 4 months after the season's finished. So we won't actually know the injury audit data until sometime this time next year, when this season's finished and they've had the summer to tally it all up. So really, it's all hypothetical. It's all sort of trying to put things together. But I mean, I can see where they're coming from. It makes sense. The ball is in play more. There's more tackles. Therefore, you're likely to see more injuries due to collision. But it's all theoretical at the moment. I'd wait for the actual figures sometime next year before you can definitely say what's what.
Well, once they do come out, I have absolutely no doubt that you will be the man to provide them on that podcast, Andy.
Oh, yeah, without doubt.
Right, let's get stuck into the weekend's games in the Premiership then. And I think a good place to start is going to be Exeter against Newcastle, reigning champions last year against a side that have surprised many. Probably not us, but even us, I don't think we quite predicted they would be doing this well. And it was a 34-24 win for Exeter. Try bonus points for both sides. And I think overall it's fair to say that Newcastle were never really in danger of winning it, but to actually only lose by 10 points at Sandy Park, still get a try bonus point in a game that you didn't particularly threaten to win, actually, if anything, strengthens the feeling towards them about being a proper side this year.
Yeah, they came back into it well. They were sort of exited, if you like, at the start. Exeter did what they do best. They keep possession nicely. They play phases and then they can break on you. The try Nick White scored was very nice. 5-meter line out. from 5 meter lineouts, if Exeter don't drive you over, they go phase, 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 and eventually they're going to score. Then Lockie Turner scores off a nice sort of 1-2 between Simmons and White, which is that I think I've seen quite a few of them this year where the nine gives it to a player running on, holds, and then the player gives it back inside to the nine and lets the defence go, and he goes through the gap and Turner scores. And then all of a sudden, Newcastle are sort of chasing it a little bit. But like you say, they've done well to stay in it. And actually, if their kicking had been a little bit better, which is not like Takalua this season, he's been very good off the tee. He was only 50%. They could have come away with 2 points, the try bonus point and the losing bonus point. And that's not a bad day's work down at Sandy Park. And I don't think Exeter and Falcons are going to be too upset with their day's work, really.
Well, no, not apart from Dean Richards, if you take his tone in his post-match interview with anything to go by. I mean, I know he never particularly comes across as a happy-go-lucky type of man anyway, but he really didn't sound thrilled when he was discussing the game in interviews afterwards. But I do quite like that. You know, we've spoken in completely different contexts, but about teams like Worcester. They don't want these patronising pats on the head of, you're doing quite well, but everyone expects you to lose or to slip up eventually. He really seems to be trying to embed that winner's attitude. And I really do like that. You know, yes, they put in a good performance. They've actually impressed a lot of people in a loss. But he's saying, actually, that's not enough. These are the things we need to work on. This is what we need to do better. And he just seems like he really is doing something special there. But I do like that attitude from Dean Richards as well.
Yeah, and a lot of the, I mean, you know, a lot of the stats will say the game was very even, similar amount of tackles, similar amount of possession, line out, scrums. The one stat that I think could be possibly down to the way they lost it was that Newcastle had two players put in the sin bin. I struggle with the, I know it's a penalty these days, and it's the Fenn Cicino did when he transferred the ball and he went to hand him off and he didn't quite get his arm straight, so he sort of elbowed him in the neck region. I get it, but it's difficult because if he'd lowered his arm a little bit and his elbow had gone into his midriff, into, say, his sternum, nothing would have happened. It's just because it just happened that the player ducked a little bit and he got him in the chin and he's been yellow carded. And I think Exeter scored a try when he was off. You know, it's those little things that they're going to get right. And the one point I made on this on my notes was, I think Falcons are trying to get to where Exeter are. They've built very slowly. They've got nice, experienced players in. Not too many superstars, similar to Exeter, but a good team mentality. They all know the game plan. And I think in a couple of years, perhaps even next year, if they get their acquisitions right, they could be the same sort of side that Exeter are now.
Well, they are building it in the same way, aren't they? It's very Exeter-like. There's not really many big names. They're players that they've built, which are now becoming names through performances, as opposed to trying to buy them in the first place. And there's huge parallels, I think, you can draw between them. And it is hugely impressive. And I think, again, even having said that, though, Sam Simmons for Exeter, he's another player who a lot of people wouldn't have known about last season, who they produced. And he had another standout performance from number eight, didn't he? You know, capped off with a wonderful try. But I think the most important thing about that is the pace of the man, because he left Van der Merwe for dead when he got that ball. And you kind of have to rub your eyes a little bit and remember, this is a number eight. I think is the only potential issue, which we try and kind of draw on a lot of the time, is people are speaking about an England call-up, particularly given the number of injuries in that area. But I just wonder, I know he's still relatively new, but is he going to be Eddie Jones type of number eight, given the sheer size of the people he usually picks?
I think it's a different type of power he's got, though. He's very squat, and I mean his thighs and his bottom half are so big and powerful that actually he might not have the height of a Vunipola, but I imagine if you put them both on a squat rack, they're going to be doing similar sort of numbers. So he's not going to want for power, but he also isn't going to do the same sort of runs where he goes straight at people. You saw the footwork for that try. He's got a lovely step. He's almost going to try and run at soft shoulders inside and out and break tackles that way. And like you say, with that pace, he gives you such options off the back of this scrum. If you can wheel the scrum around slightly, and you know, you've got a clever nine like Youngs or Kerr to block the opposition nine in, he's got pace to make yards straight away. And again, it's with the back row, it's always about balance. So Jones would have to look seriously if you're going to put him in at eight. I think he is quite a like-for-like replacement with Vunipola, so I don't think you have to change things too much. He's not a line-out forward, so it doesn't matter too much. I think you could easily put him in there with probably Robshaw and then whoever he picks at seven.
Yeah, lots of decisions though. Lots of injuries for England, but particularly in the back row, lots and lots of talent and promising players, and be very interesting to see what happens in the autumn. Right, let's leave that game there, and we'll move on to Gloucester against Northampton. So Gloucester, I think, are even out-Gloucestering themselves at the moment. Opening day win against the champions, complete dross. There were a number of games afterwards. And then a week after conceding 57 points to Sale, they go and beat the current table toppers, Saints.
I, as you can see, I'm struggling for words. It's the nature of the performance. It's the passion that they're able to generate for themselves off the back of the King's Home crowd. And I heard Jim Hamilton talking and saying when he was captain at Gloucester, he wished he'd made a point of trying to get them to G themselves up when they're away from home, because they just seem to be able to feed off that crowd, that passionate West Country support, and it just gives them that extra, almost, you know, you normally sell it 1% or 2%, but in their case, it's almost like an extra 15, 20%'s worth of sort of something. And they play brilliant rugby. They're at it, they're on it, accurate pace, power. And then all of a sudden they go away from King's Home and they just look like they're, oh, you know, it's not at home, we don't mind, whatever. You know, we haven't got, you know, 10,000 angry Gloucester fans here if we play badly. But they played a really, really good game. They held Saints on the gain line, which is the important thing. Saints play that power game around the corner. You've got to stop them getting the ball, getting their go forward, and then being able to unleash their runners. And for the most part, they managed to hold them. And that was that. Then they could play their own game. I thought Hines was very good. He seemed to marshal things very nicely and sort of bring people on. And if Trinder stays fit, I'd give him till after Christmas. But if you can get a run of games together, he's pushing Daly, Joseph and Slade for that 13 shirt.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, about Trinder over the last few years and if he stays fit, and he's finally having a run of games and he's showing people exactly what all the fuss is about. He's been really impressive and he seems to have a nice blend of determination and class as well. And, you know, it's another couple of tries for him, but it's just the manner of the tries as well, isn't it? He's one of those players that he does look class when you see him on the pitch. But they, you know, they're going to need players like Trinder, because not only was this a good win, Saints, after their opening day stinker, have actually been very, very impressive. And this was a game, I think, even last season, I know we spoke about King's Home, but Gloucester, I think, lost more league games last year than they actually won at home. It was only by one, but they still did. And I think that they had several games that were decided by 7 points and they lost all of them. And last season, this could well have actually been one of those games again, with the lead changing hands 6 times, very back and forth. But it's players like that that are going to make the difference for them. And they, at times I thought they might give it away still. When I was looking at the highlights, they really did make some silly mistakes when they'd finally got themselves a decent lead. You know, there was a line out in their 22 and they just ended up overthrowing, gave away a pen at the resulting scrum, and then they're on the back foot. And then I think Woodward in the second half got the ball in zone 22, defence are rushing towards him, kick over the top of them, loads of space, get a bit of territory, decided to run the ball, pass it, knock on, and before you know it, there's a penalty and 2 lineouts later and Saints have scored a try and they're back in it. And they do need to just temper that enthusiasm a little bit. I love attacking rugby. I love having that mindset. But you do need to play the situation. And at times, to stop being your own worst enemy, they need to remember when actually they need to play percentages.
And that is where your leaders come in. And I think they've obviously had a few injuries. Slater wasn't there because he got injured in the warm-up. Ben Morgan's not there. Owen Williams has only just arrived to play 10. And I think hopefully that leadership group will build and they'll get that together where someone will just say, "Oi, Jason, just don't do that. Kick it. Get it out. Trust me, you know, if you're Ed Slater, trust me, I'll disrupt their line out, we'll sort it out. Don't go running out of your own 22 when we've got the lead." And that's for the other I put down on here, I think Saints, actually, as much as Gloucester played well and won, Saints messed it up a little bit. They missed what could have been the best try of the season when Reinach made the break, absolute pace for an 9, chipped it forward and George North knocked on with about a yard to go. And the last play of the game, they get a 5 metre line out, they've already driven them over once. And they get done for obstruction. I mean, it was very simple, simple errors they made at the end that could have cost that could have snatched it off Gloucester. So as much as Gloucester were very good, I wouldn't be too worried if I was a Saints fan, because a few little tweaks and they could have easily walked away from that with 5 points.
It's amazing, isn't it, how our opinions have just changed about everyone. This game has just seemed to kind of sum up the season so far, with 1 minute someone's in front, the next minute they're behind. Gloucester losing by 57 and then coming back to win, and Saints on the opening day. It has been a bit of a nightmare season for predictions and trying to figure out actually what the hell's going on with teams. And this just seemed to sum it up perfectly.
Yeah, but it makes it more fun.
It does make it more fun, and I'm sure we'll get stuck into Gloucester for losing next week when that pod comes around. Right, so the third feature game we had was Saracens against Wasps, which was a 38 points to 19 win with a try bonus point for Saracens. It's a game that on paper you might look at and think, massive game for the weekend, but given Wasps' recent troubles and injuries, not really an altogether surprising result, is it? And it wasn't much of a contest.
No, I think it says a lot about this game that actually Wasps had 58% of the possession, but you never thought they were going to win. Saracens only needed 40% of the ball, and they did so much more with it that it was unbelievable. I think the stat that's back up for me are the meters that players make. And at 12 for Wasps, Mackin made no meters all game. How can you play 12 in a Premiership game and not make any meters? You know, you should at least be carrying some ball, doing something. There was just nothing there really from Wasps that got me excited until they were too far behind. They'd switched off for two easy tries for the first two from Wiles and George. I mean, you don't give away a tap penalty in your 22 and let the hooker walk in from 20 yards. It's not even like it was the winger. I know George is, you know, pretty nippy for a fat bloke, but you don't let him walk in like that. And Haskell and I think Ashley Johnson were having a chat. It was just unacceptable. I imagine Dai Young is going to have laid into them, but they could have still escaped with a try bonus point if they'd kicked the conversion quicker at the end. It was just, they just need to write this off and just forget about it, because I know they've got a lot of injuries and they're obviously not on form. They've also got a horrible turnaround for their game this week on Friday in Ulster. And as much as Saracens were their usual ruthless, efficient selves, Lisowski played very well, Barrett did anything, no obvious standout performers for Saracens, but it was just that well-oiled slick machine going through what they do best, getting the tries, kicking the goals. And if I was Wasps, yeah, I'd just write it off and pretend it never happened.
Yeah, it did seem inevitable, didn't it, all game? And things that we've spoken about with Gloucester wanting leaders, it's not just the number of injuries to Wasps. But when you think that they're missing Cipriani and Gopeth and Launchbury and Hughes, they're four of the players you think other players would look to and certainly wouldn't stand for that lackluster, having a granny's meeting and disorganisation that allows people to nip in for quick tries. And it's not just the number, is it? It's the players and the leaders that have got injured for them. And all of a sudden, they look just all at sea. And it's going to be a struggle for them, whoever they're playing, I think, at the moment, given the state they're in. And yeah, it's Ulster away in 4 days after that. That's not what you want. I think Dai Young, who possibly could have been a poet or a philosopher in a previous life, said it pretty well. He said, when your luck's down, everyone keeps kicking you in the nuts. And it may not go on many books in a library, but it kind of summed up their situation very well at the moment, I think.
Yeah, and I think we talked about it before, that they're going to miss Curtly Beale, who's very good. But I think they've got LaRue there, who they must be paying big, big bucks to. He's got to be on a fair wedge. And he just doesn't look bothered. You know, when Beale was there last season, he was firing up the crowd, he was getting into it. He looked like he was really, you know, part of the team and he could G people up, like you say, a leader. And when you pay big money for someone like Willie LaRue, you expect him to be doing that job a little bit as well. And I just think he's not worth the money at the moment. And obviously, like you say, it doesn't help when you've got Rob Miller at fly half, who isn't really a proper fly half. But they let Alex Lisowski go, and it's quite ironic that he was on the other side covering for an injured Owen Farrell and had a great game. So it's some personnel decisions that have not quite gone right for Wasps there.
Yeah, just a quick point in their defence before we move on is that LaRue doesn't quite look as fired up as Beale did before, but it is going to be difficult when you've lost half your forward pack, including some of your biggest ball carriers that get you across the gain line to give you the ball so people like LaRue and Beale can do something with it. And then even the playmakers that can feed LaRue into it, you know, Gopeth and Sips both out. Lava Balavu, who was superb at the start of the season, injured as well. They're just broken at the moment. And I thought LaRue did actually look pretty tasty for the first couple of weeks. And, you know, maybe once they've actually got a few more forwards back and they're, you know, at least one playmaker, we'll start to see some more of him.
Yeah, I say it wasn't necessarily his play. His play has been a bit substandard. So it's more the attitude. You want him going into the huddles and G'ing people up and getting on to Rob Miller and trying to, you know, encourage him and getting him going. And it's more like, oh, he's at fullback and I'm just going to stand there and perhaps just collect my money and play my game and I'll be all right. One of those things, I don't know. It's just the attitude I got off him.
Right, well, before we disagree anymore or slag off LaRue, we'll shift on to Quins against Sale. So 42-26 to Quins. Try bonus points for both. Another game where injuries are talking points. I mean, to start before the game even kicked off, Quins horrible out, failed a late concussion test, already missing a couple. But they really started with purpose, didn't they? And they put in a really quite impressive performance to take a comfortable win.
Yeah, to get your three tries inside 24 minutes, it was, I mean, I was really looking forward to this because of Danny Kerr versus Faf de Klerk, and Danny Kerr won that match hands down, no bother. It wasn't even a contest. He was exceptional. It was one of those games where you wonder why Danny Kerr isn't England starting scrum half all the time, and then you'll probably watch him next week and you'll remember why he's not starting scrum half for England all the time. And they'd obviously identified something in Sale where they could chip over the top, and they chipped over the top quite a lot, stopped this Sale defence, and they scored a couple of tries like that. Marcus Smith was pulling the strings really, really well. And like you say, they just shell-shocked Sale in the first 24 minutes and then they could coast from there. They didn't actually get the fourth try till very late, but the game was pretty much over as a contest by that point. And Sale will be happy to take a losing bonus point back up to Manchester and, you know, perhaps look at the performance of Josh Strauss, who I thought was very, very good. I think he's been an excellent acquisition at number 8. And the try Mike Haley scored was a beautiful thing to watch. So yeah, they'll take a point and be happy with it. And Quins have got to back it up this week in Europe.
Yeah, and I mean, for all the players that were lost by Quins, you know, they've got Visser back and he made a huge impact on his return. And a lot of that was fed in by what he'd picked up on the kicks. It clearly was a plan, but Kerr's kicking was spot on. Absolutely spot on that game. He really was putting it on a sixpence every time, and Sale just couldn't cope. But Visser is a bit of a lethal weapon for Quins. When he plays, his strike rate is incredibly impressive, and I think they'll be very pleased to get him back, especially with Clifford, poor bugger, getting injured again. So there's lots of kind of mixed things, I think, in there for Quins, but at the end of the day, it's at the Stoop, Sale away. It's not a huge surprise. My biggest concern, I'm going to quote another head coach for you here, Andy, but Steve Diamond said, "We didn't get off the bus with the right mentality." Now, I'm not being funny, but that's not really acceptable. This isn't a new thing for Sale, the away games they don't perform. This is also going to a ground where the home team are incredibly good at home. Why are you getting off the bus with the right mentality, and what are you doing about it? I thought it was probably a bit of an odd thing to come out publicly and say, but it just made me think, why?
Well, that's his job. That's what he's paid to do. He's paid to get the team ready. Now, he must know his team. He's been at Sale for years now. It's not like he's a new head coach and he's not quite sure how to work certain players, you know, how to get them going. He should know exactly how his team works and the best ways to G them up before a game. It shouldn't be something new to him. But like you say, I agree with what he said. They didn't get off the bus. They didn't start playing. In my notes I've written on this game, I said Sale's first set of good phases was in the 31st minute and they scored their try in the 32nd. It came from their first set of good play. They were knocking on. They were inaccurate. They were trying to play too flat to the gain line and getting beaten by the Quins rush defence. Yeah, it's his job and he needs to work out how he's got to get them G'd up away from home before a game.
Well, we'll see if they can manage it. I don't think I've got too much faith. Right. Irish against Leicester. So talking of things that we know teams do and then not sorting them out, Irish have had loads of really sluggish starts and they spoke in the week about not having a sluggish start. So they conceded a try in the first couple of minutes. Eventually ended up 27-28, so they did get a losing bonus point. But again, you know, sluggish start, why? Why? What is this problem that people just can't address? I just don't understand it. Home game, go for it. Really, really frustrating. But in the end, actually, a very, very valuable point they got in a losing cause.
Yeah, again, other than the game up at Falcons, where I thought they started really well until about 20 minutes and then Newcastle got that three-try brace on them, Irish haven't started well. And again, it's you hear about people like Eddie Jones going in and watching Pep Guardiola, and you hear about like famous basketball coaches in America going to sit in with American football teams and all that sort of cross-diversity of knowledge. Perhaps the Northern Irish guys need to go and just sit in with a completely different sport, something completely different, and just see how people get G'd up, how they get themselves ready. Because if they don't change what they're doing, you know, they're not going to get any different. It's that Einstein thing. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Change the warm-up. Change where people sit in the changing room. Change the music. Change something and see if you can get a reaction out of the players. Because at the moment, like you say, they come out, they look half asleep, they wake up after 25 minutes. Oh no, you're already two or three tries down. Nick Kennedy comes out after the game and says, oh, we didn't start very well, did we? And you're like, well, yeah, well, you know, you should be looking at it and doing something.
Yeah, and another thing we've spoken about is what looked like a fairly solid defence at the start has had some pretty gaping holes in it recently. And then, again, for another one of Leicester's tries, Ticker Atuma, it looked like he was walking off the pitch to get the bus or something. I don't know, the kind of gap he'd left, which Leicester just thought thanks very much and trotted through. And you know, if there's anything they need to focus on, it's starting much, much faster and just working on communication between the defenders and where people are going to stand and just, you know, using your head a little bit. Because one thing that they are doing is showing flashes of quality and showing that they can finish and score tries. And I think it's inevitable that we will compare them a lot to Worcester this season because they're very much the two that are getting cut off from the rest. But I think positives that we can see from Irish are that they are scoring these tries, showing flashes of quality that I'm not necessarily seeing from Worcester. And even though this game was lost, the score makes it look a lot tighter than it was because they were 28-13 down with 10 minutes left. But to come back and score those two tries, these are all, whether it's losing bonus points or try bonus points, it's points that they're picking up that Worcester aren't. And that is what is ultimately going to decide who stays up, nicking these points. And I think they can be quite pleased actually overall.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like you say, losing bonus point against Tigers, they'll take it. Alex Lewington is a massive positive. I mean, I'm not sure whether he'll be there next season. He should be playing Champions Cup rugby. He looks exceptional. And why Tigers let him go in the first place, I don't know. A couple of other points on this game. I always like to see a fat man running lots of distance to score. David Pace, great try. Always a pleasure to see. But I'm going to touch on Leicester. They'll be disappointed. That is, when you start the season, this is where you need to get your extra bonus points from. You look at the league table, and what you've got at the moment is you've got Exeter in second. They've won the same amount of games as Leicester. They've both won four games, but Exeter have got five more points. They've got six bonus points from their games. Leicester have one try bonus point for their... Oh, I don't think it was a try bonus point. It was a losing bonus point against Bath they got. And that's it. They are not putting teams to the sword to get these points. And it could end up knocking them out of the... out of the top four at the end of the season, because Northampton have got try bonus points. Newcastle certainly have. Exeter are. They need to start scoring some more tries. And as much as, you know, Tamua looks exceptional, I mean, they had him last season. It was unfortunate he got injured. The pass he put over for Johnny May's try was brilliant. And if they need to start turning those plays more and more into tries, because otherwise I think they're going to look at the end of the season and go, oh, well, we've actually won more games than the team in fourth, but they're not in there because they haven't got the bonus points.
They will potentially get there. I think one thing you can say about Leicester is from the start they've had, they've not really been a topsy-turvy team. They're a team that seems to be slowly progressing week on week. Tamua has been pretty good all season, but him and Ford together seem to be playing a little bit better together each game. And I know you pointed out Tamua's pass for May, but his passing all game was bang on. And particularly those longer passes, which look a lot more straightforward than they are sometimes. He's got serious talent to do it. And yes, they will probably be disappointed, particularly from the position they're in, not to get a try bonus point. But I think they do look like they're heading in the right direction. But they also look a bit of a step below, I think, maybe the top couple of sides. But, you know, can't trust anyone this season. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Just one more thing on Leicester. Just Johnny May. That's what I want to say. Just, yeah.
Overrated. Right. So last game, which we probably can skim over very quickly, was a predictable routine try bonus point win for Bath at home to Worcester. It wasn't a landslide, but it was 29-13. there was pretty much nothing new, I don't think, from either side. Probably biggest thing that happened in the game was Burns' red card, I would say. I don't know if you agree with that, but really not a lot to talk about in terms of the actual gameplay.
No, other than Zach Mercer having another stormer. He's slowly getting more and more game time, and I think he's going to be on Eddie Jones's radar very soon. But no, like you say, the Burns thing, by the letter of the law, it's a red card. I've heard people talk about it. Yes, it was a red card. He tipped him and he landed more on his head than he did on his arm. It was just more the fact that the ref saw it and went yellow card, and he was sitting on the bench off the pitch, and then he decided to have a look at it again. Why not just straight away go, I'm not sure, let's have a look, rather than get him off the pitch, on the pitch? It was like doing the hokey cokey on and off before he actually worked out what was going on.
Yeah, and I think they've come out today and he's got a 3-week ban, and I just think it's absurd. Fine, yes, it's letter of the law, it's a red card, but there was no intent in that. 3 weeks just seems so over the top. And I just despise the whole, the fact that the outcome has a huge part in what the punishment is. And I just think, well, someone could do a far more dangerous tackle, which they look like they might actually be trying to do. Just because someone sticks an arm out and manages to break their fall with their elbow, that person should not be getting a lesser ban than someone who's just been a bit overzealous. And the way someone's fallen, they've then hit their head. I just hate the whole, the fact that the outcome decides the punishment. I think it's a bit of a ridiculous rule.
Yeah, it's one of those where it's tricky because obviously if someone breaks their neck, then they're going to get worse. But I mean, in this case, what I find weird is that last week we had Kyle Sinclair getting banned for 7 weeks for what was clearly contact with the eye area, which is a much more heinous.
I don't know if it was clear.
But it was 12 weeks down to 7. And when you think that some people who've done that similar thing, sort of Chris Ashton got about 3 or 4 months for it, people got a lot longer. There's only a 4-week difference between what Burns did and then what Sinclair did. And yet I think that what Sinclair has been charged with is a much greater offence than what Burns has done. And like you say, it's that consistency in the punishments. And Bath are going to miss him because Bath are down to a rookie, sort of was playing semi-pro rugby at number 10 in Wales last season to start at 10 this week with Fotalihi, who's actually a 9 as their backup 10 because Priestland's injured, their academy boy's injured and Burns suspended. So it's going to be a struggle for them in Europe this week.
Few teams going into Europe with a... not ideal injuries at the moment, isn't there? But we'll see how it goes. Right, that's the wrap-up of the games. So we'll head straight into Premiership Try of the Week. What options have you got for us, Mr. Wenborn?
I've got the David Pace try, again, just because I like to see front row forwards in open space looking bewildered and scared for their lives. Sam Simmons' effort for Exeter, but I'm going to pick Henry Trinder's first effort for Gloucester. Lovely step, pace, bit of power. It was just everything you want to see from an outside centre when he got the ball, and you just, the old sort of Jerry Guscott style, bit of a drift, pace, round the outside, and then just go and have the determination to make the line. Always gets the crowd on their feet, always gets everyone going, and I thought it was a wonderful effort.
Yeah, completely agree with that. I think it was a very good try. I can't give him try of the week because as good as it was, I like a graceful try, and he was literally falling over twice, three times before he got over. So I'm going to penalise him. I did also quite like Jonathan Joseph's try. And I don't think it was all round the best try, but purely it was just a finish for me. The fact he managed to slam on the brakes so quickly and then get the ball down, I thought was very, very impressive. But the try I spoke about earlier in the Exeter games, my try of the week, it's Simmons' try. Purely for the pace he showed as a number 8 to leave Van der Merwe for dead, but then just do 2 steps, I think it was, at pace. I just thought it was incredible athleticism for a back rower. So Sam Simmons gets mine. Right, hit of the week. What have you got for a Sunday with hit of the week?
Well, I was talking to you about this. I haven't actually got a hit of the week this week. Now, for many reasons, including work, I didn't get to watch all of the games live, and in the highlights, they don't tend to show the big booming hits. So I'm going to plead the fifth and say I've sadly not got a hit of the week this week, and I apologise.
Okay. Thank you for informing me of your American heritage. I didn't realise you had as well.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's three times removed on my dad's side somewhere, I think.
Well, I do have a hit of the week, which is pretty much, it's also my binge you. So if you don't mind, I will just go straight into that before handing over to you.
By all means.
So my hit of the week is the hit on any England fan's wallet that decides to buy the latest replica rugby shirt for England internationals. Now, this has a few elements to it, which is why it leads into bin juice. Now, first off, it's 95 quid. And I'm sorry, but that's just far too much. I just think it's a disgusting price. You know, especially when you've got people and rugby is very much a family game. And when you're taking kids and you want to take them to Twickenham and see internationals and kids want shirts, if you have to buy even, you know, one of those, I think is ridiculous. But if you had to buy two or three of those, it's just outrageous. And nothing anyone can say to me will justify putting that price tag on it of 95. Just absolutely outrageous. But also, this is the 10th England replica kit in just over 3 years. That's just not acceptable. It's just complete exploitation of loyal fans and proper fans. And it gets even worse because potentially they might only wear this kit once. So I think they're due to wear it against Argentina in the Autumn Internationals, and then they're going to wear white in the other two, and then it's Six Nations, where England usually wear white throughout. Now, yeah, as I say, I'm just going to leave it at that. It's basically complete exploitation. It can't be justified. It's unacceptable, and I hate it.
You done?
Yeah, I'm done now, mate.
Right, I've got a couple of things for bin juice this week. First of all is Rob Andrew. He can go and sit in a bin for as long as he likes. Just you can tell he's got a book to sell, can't you? He's just come out and made ludicrous comments about what happened in the World Cup when England went out, about Stuart Lancaster having an obsession with Sam Burgess and wanting to play him. Well, it wasn't Stuart Lancaster who was working at the RFU when the RFU helped pay for Sam Burgess to come over and play for Bath. So someone at the RFU, which apparently Rob Andrew was in charge of at the time, or one of the main men there, obviously allegedly paid to help, you know, get him over. And then I don't actually think that we had a problem at 12 anyway at that point in time, as England fans will know. We didn't have the sort of nice midfield options that we do today. People were very against having Ford and Farrell play together. I remember reading a lot of articles, oh, it won't work and Farrell's not a 12 and you can't do that. And actually, what Burgess did really well in the game against Wales was very good. He bottled Jamie Roberts a poor game until, for some reason, then this is where Stuart Lancaster has to take some of the blame, he took him off. And then all of a sudden, Jamie Roberts got going over the game line and Wales came back into it. I just don't think there's any need for Rob Andrew to throw him under the bus. It was just absolutely ridiculous thing to say. And like I say, it's clear that he's got a book to sell because his sales are probably going through the roof and his publishers are very happy with him. The other thing for bin juice is the organisation of the Champions Cup and the fact that, like, we've already touched on Wasps having a 5-day turnaround. But I mean, I think Scarlets have got the worst one this week. They go to Toulon on Sunday, and rather than then give them a Saturday or a Sunday game next week, they're playing Friday night in Wales against Bath. So they've got a 5-day turnaround. And what that does is, if you have a head injury, the protocol for return for head injury is 6 days. So if you have a 5-day turnaround, if anyone takes a knock to the head, they're out of the game, definitely. And there must have been some way they could organise these fixtures so at least every team had 6 days. I can't see that TV or anybody is going to get in the way. If you just say, no, every team needs 6 days for head injuries, then you could do it. And I just think if Scarlets take a full team to Toulon and play a very difficult game, they could end up then having a second string side out against Bath and almost ruining their chances of getting through before they've started. So I just think someone's got to organise that a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. I unfortunately do think it is broadcasters and TV money, and they rule and they make the big decisions. Anyway, before I get set off on that one as well, we'll get stuck into Pro 14. So we've got a couple of main games to talk about. We'll start with the Irish derby game at the RDS between Leinster and Munster. So unfortunately, it was a 23-17 win for Leinster, with the losing bonus point for Munster. Really, it was a deserved win for Leinster. They were the better side on the day. And Sexton became Leinster's all-time point scorer, overtaking Felipe Contepomi. So pretty good day out for Leinster. I don't think anyone's too fussed about massive wins or bonus points when it's a derby. You just want to get the win, really, don't you?
Yeah, and I think Leinster were able to control a lot of the game, which surprised me given that Munster had three fly halves on the pitch. I mean, there's obviously problems in their back line if they're having to play three fly halves. I don't think it's obviously by choice. But you'd have thought they'd been able to sort of control the territory a bit better, at least try and pin Leinster back a little bit more. But Leinster had far, far more territory, more possession, and then were able to do more with it. And the only other thing is, how do teams still fall for the Johnny Sexton wraparound? Right?
I mean,
I know he did it with Furlong, so people were probably a little bit shocked. Like, what? The prop's doing it? It's what's going on? But he did the wraparound, made space, and then O'Loughlin scored his try. I was like, how? No, you must. It's his, not his one move, but it's his main move. Surely you've seen it on the video analysis.
Yeah, there's other moves, probably concussion, but anyway. I was texting a few of my in-laws who were Leinster fans during that, and I was just astonished that they fell for it. And I just thought, of all people as well, how many of this Munster team have played with Sexton? They've seen it before at club, they've played with him at international level, and it does blow my mind a little bit that people still fall for it and he gets it. Munster definitely were suffering from a few injuries, and they don't quite have the squad that Leinster do to be able to cover for it. And that combined, I think, with Blaendahl, who was one of the standout performers for Munster last year, has been woefully out of form. And I think that probably contributed towards the different fly halves on the pitch. But I know we spoke about Harlequins and Danny Kerr utilising kicks in behind. But the kicks that were aimed at particularly at the right wing, but also to the fullback, Munster just couldn't cope. They just couldn't cope at all. And Leinster just were doing it again and again and again. And that forced a bit of a reshuffle to get a taller man in at wing and fullback, and JJ Hammerins then switch into fly half. But it was just constantly reacting to what was happening. I think when Munster get players like Zeebo and John Klein back, it will certainly help. But I think it was a bit of a result to get a losing bonus point in the end. And biggest positive was that Keith Earls looked absolutely electric all game.
Yeah, I mean, he scored a couple of nice tries. His first one from the break, O'Donnell's break, so I get my words out. Yeah. It was a really nice try. I just feel that, I mean, do you think their Lions are suffering a little bit? Imani was... Nah. And CJ Stander didn't really seem to get into the game as much as, you know, you'd have thought in a big derby game. You're going to look at your big ball carrier, and he just wasn't quite at it.
No, I think that there was a lot of that, and I do think the Lions are slowly coming back into it. They obviously missed the first few weeks, then only really came back the previous week or so. So they're probably still feeling their way into it a little bit. But then at the same time, as much as I think those two are absolutely brilliant, and I think Omani's just an absolute genius, you know, Leinster do have a ridiculous back row. And in fact, they've got serious options. They've pretty much been rotating for the last couple of weeks. And when they, you know, Heaslip hasn't even been fit, but, you know, they didn't have Sean O'Brien, but they've had Jack Conan, who's exceptional. They've got Reece Ruddock, who's very solid, will do a job. They've got Van der Fleer coming in. They just have so many more options. And I think that they certainly looked fresher than Munster. And, you know, that they do have a squad to be able to cope with the demands of playing away in South Africa, which is new this year, and then rotating things before Europe. So they're in a very strong position, I think, Leinster. Right, move on, shall we? So next game, I know one that we were really looking forward to. Glasgow travelling to South Africa to play the Cheetahs, who are unbeaten at home. Really close game. Ended up 26-29 with yet another try bonus point for Glasgow, another win for Glasgow. But a good performance from Cheetahs and a losing bonus point.
Yeah, I mean, what a game. Cheetahs 17-10 up at half time, and you think, you know, playing at altitude, that the Glasgow players might feel it, you know, especially in the second half. But actually, they seem to come on stronger. And Finn Russell, it baffles me more and more every time I see him play how he didn't get more Lions time. I mean, I know he came out at the end and was on the bench a little bit, but he's just such a good player. He put in one chip for the a crossfield kick for the winning try that was perfection. He was part of the first try where Jackson intercepted it, ran forward. Russell was there in support, managed to give a nice offload to Gibbons to score. He just controls the game so well, and he hits the line really flat, and he's got all the moves. He's got the chips, he's got the passes, and I think he really is the player. He's sort of the Jenga piece for Glasgow. I think if he goes, the whole team could fall apart a little bit. But with him in that side, they look absolutely exceptional. And I was really, really impressed with the way they dealt with the cheaters.
One thing they will have to work on for sure is their scrum got a bit of a going over. And they managed to lose their first five lineouts, which is quite a feat, actually. So, yeah, first five throws were all wayward. So they've definitely got things to work on, but they look a serious side at the moment. And to actually have those problems, particularly at set piece, and then come away with a bonus point win away at a side that are unbeaten at home, huge positives and actually pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think that I had that 5 out of 10 lineouts written down. The other thing is they gave away 15 penalties. Now, you don't know if some of those are tiring at the end and they're just flopping about a little bit, trying to sort of slow the cheaters' ball down. But if they give away 15 penalties this week at Sandy Park, I don't think they'll get the result. And especially if they only win 50% of the lineout ball. But I mean, the stat that stands out for me in this game is they're 30 defenders beaten. That's a hell of a stat to be able to get around 30 defenders during a game, whether it's, you know, nice little moves, run throughs, and that's going to get you behind, and then the offloads, and they can just bring all of their backs through. And I really hope they perform well in Europe this year and sort of make it to the knockout stages, because they've been building it for quite a long time, and they're just such a nice side to watch.
Yeah, horrible group, but we'll discuss that later. But I actually thought this might be a difficult season for Glasgow after last year. I thought they'd maybe missed the boat a little bit in Europe from their team a couple of years ago, but they really have proved me completely wrong so far, and they come out firing, and it'd be very, very exciting to see what they can do in Europe. Right, let's crack on with some of the other Pro 14 games. Next I've got on my list is Benetton Treviso getting a bonus point win over Southern Kings. Now, yeah, it is great that the Italian sides are winning yet more games, but basically Kings are absolutely awful, and I don't really know if there's anything else to say.
Mate, they're absolutely awful. I looked at the stats on this game, saw that Treviso won, and I thought, oh, see, was it close? Nah, it wasn't close. The Kings had 40% possession. They made no clean breaks. Zero. I mean, you've got to have someone in your team at least do something where you can get past someone or make a half break or just bowl someone over, just run over the top, you know, get your eight running over the top of a nine, anything. Absolutely nothing. And they conceded 13 turnovers. If you make no clean breaks and give the ball away 13 times, you're going to get spanked. And that's pretty much what happened by the looks of it.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen a lot this season. Right. So let's go on. So we had a bit of a Welsh derby weekend with all four regions playing each other. Osprey Scarlets was 18-19. So win for Scarlets, losing point, bonus point for Ospreys. Actually much closer than I thought it was going to be given Osprey's recent form, but then I suppose Welsh pride, they probably got well stuck into it.
Yeah, and it was one of those where they were 9-0 up at half time and you were thinking, oh, they might do this, there's the chance that they might be able to come away with something here, but in the end they just couldn't hold on to it. And when you see that it was 3-0 to the Scarlets, and Steph Evans is, I mean, what a player. His step for the first Gareth Davis try. I mean, it was Jason Robinson-esque, just coming on, and the guy didn't even touch him. He was just gone and offloaded for a great try. And again, it's the things where I think the Ospreys had a lot of ball. They had more possession, they had more rucks. They just didn't seem to be able to do anything with it, and they just seemed to be lacking some, I don't know whether it's direction, which can't be right with Reese Webb and Dan Bigger there, or it must be the way they're coached, because they just don't seem to have any invention about them to do anything. They didn't make many clean breaks, didn't make many defenders, they didn't have many offloads. They just seem to be going through phases and hoping they might get a penalty or that someone might do something for them to score. It's just all a bit flat.
It probably just highlights quite how poor they've been this season, that given all of that, this is actually still an improved performance from them this past weekend. It's not really any excuse for it, given the quality of players they've got and players in key positions. And it's still going to be sore for them that they lost to another Welsh region. But there's huge problems. But at least they can probably say, given recent weeks, they're heading in the right direction, even if it's slowly. My favourite part of the game, though, is probably lots of, you know, Aggie moments, Welsh derby, players kind of, you know, winding each other up. And yet the one man who got sin-binned was Tadhg Byrne, an Irishman, for starting the big scuffle in the first place. That just kind of, that did tickle me slightly.
Well, he did run in from quite a long way.
Good lad, good lad. Looking forward to seeing him at Munster next year.
The only thing on the Ospreys, I'll add, is I was reading something for the Champions Cup, and someone had made the point that even though Treviso are in the Champions Cup, currently the Ospreys might be the worst side. And I thought that was a damning indictment of where they are.
Ouch. Yeah, that is a real burn, isn't it? right, so the other Welsh derby was Cardiff Dragons. I think we were both expecting maybe a bit of a turgid, low-scoring affair. So obviously it was 43-29 with tri-bonus points everywhere. I suppose it's the result we predicted, isn't it, with Cardiff winning? Given Dragons 31 injuries, it's not actually that bad either, is it?
I can't believe that stat. It's obscene. I mean, they're calling people up from the Welsh League left, right and centre, you know, the sort of semi-pro league. But they were 21-10 up at half-time and they scored some great tries. The first try by Warren was brilliant. I mean, they started in their own half, nice offloads, nice hands. And then it just, I think, I don't know whether it was Tidus. Obviously, you can't tell on the TV whether there was weather involved, whether there was a massive wind for them in the first half or anything like that. And that pitch they've got at Cardiff actually should probably bring about more games like this. The pitch at the Arms Park used to be awful, sort of muddy and horrible by this time of year. But now they've got that 4G plastic pitch. They were running it from everywhere. Morgan scored a couple of blistering tries for Cardiff. And once they got into their going, I think perhaps the fact that all those injuries that the Dragons have got caught up with them and they just couldn't quite hang with the Blues once they got themselves going and were able to run away with it in the end.
Yeah, and that is now 26 away games lost in a row for the Dragons in the Pro 12 and Pro 14.
You must have read the same stats pack that I did.
Great away form. They're making Sale look good. Right, Edinburgh Zebra. So Cockerill, he declared this was a must-win game after losing to Zebra last season and losing to Treviso this season, and they scraped it by the skin of their teeth, 16-15. Ends a run of three defeats for them, but I'm not really sure if there's huge amounts of positives for them. It was scrappy. It was a home game against the Italian side, which they barely won. Loads of errors. Not really a lot to say. Just it's a bit gloomy for Edinburgh this year.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot to say if you're Richard Cockerill. Have you not heard he's basically blamed the referee. He's come out and he's had a right go at the standard of refereeing in the Pro 14.
This is Richard Cockerill, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's his raison d'être. But that's it. He just seems not to want to say we were a bit poor. He said there was, you know, they were offside from kickoffs. They were doing this. They were doing that. It's not my fault. No, your team, you just got to sometimes say, you know, he inherited not a very good team. They weren't very good last season. And he's not going to be able to turn it around in 6 weeks. I don't know whether he thinks he's got some magic spell. But what he needs to do is perhaps try and change the style of performance. Like you say, it's turgid and it's awful. And they're one of the teams in the Pro 14 that actually I'm not that bothered about watching. You know, when you see how the Scarlets play and Ulster and Leinster can play and Glasgow, and they've all got very nice sort of attractive game styles, Edinburgh are just not very good to watch. Other than the McAnally try that was scored was an excellent finish. And again, another fat man in space, Hooker on the charge. But yeah, I was actually more impressed with the sort of the play that Zebra put together than by Edinburgh. It just so happened that Edinburgh were able to sort of grind them down and get the penalties to win the game.
Yeah, it's another game, isn't it, where actually the team that lost probably come out with far more credit than the team that won. And Cockerill, he will moan, he will shout. He will turn the air blue with his language, but he's going to have to do a lot more than that to get Edinburgh playing, I think.
Yeah, and they had 33% possession in that game. That's awful. That is
embarrassing. right, well, we'll leave them because that's what that game deserves. And so to conclude the Pro 14 round, it was a bit of a weekend of derby games, wasn't it? You know, between the nations, we've got Ulster against Connacht. It finished 16-8 in what was a relatively tight contest. Connacht leading at half time, but Ulster just doing enough to turn it around in the second half and take the points.
I think Ulster have got to thank Mr. Cooney for his kicking ability. 100% from the tee, whereas Connacht are only 50%, and that in the end probably proved the difference. Yeah, it's one of those when it's a derby, you know it's going to be tight, especially up at Ravenhill when, you know, it's perhaps a Friday night, weather's a bit poor, you're not going to get the same sort of expansive game you might get on a nice dry summer's evening. But they did what they had to do, Ulster. They got the victory. They've got the best player on the pitch by a mile in Charles Piatow, who just looks a class above quite a lot of people. And yeah, they managed to grind it out and get the win. But whether they'll be happy with the result and the performance, that, you know, that's up for their management to decide. But 4 points is 4 points, and you take it going into Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Collins haven't won in Belfast for 57 years, I don't think. So that, yeah, it was always going to be, I think, Ulster winning. It was closer than I thought it was going to be. Given some of Ulster's earlier season form, they suddenly seem to have gone off the boil slightly with losing the previous week and now only just winning against Connacht. But they've certainly going to have bigger fish to fry at the weekend, and I would fully expect them to be coming out with a much better performance in Europe.
Yeah, the only point on this I was looking at is what's happened to Tommy Bow? Because he was pretty anonymous in this game. He had 3 carries for 2 metres, only made about 4 tackles, and you expect him to be a lot more involved in the game. He was one of those busy wingers, used to get his hands on the ball, try and get involved, but he seems to have just sort of gone off the boil a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, he wasn't really up to much last season either. He has had a lot of injury problems over the last couple of years, but it does seem quite a steep drop off. It's like he's kind of fallen off a cliff a little bit. He was, you know, everyone was raving about him. He was plucking high balls out of the air in the Six Nations for fun, and he's at the speedster when he gets going. But I'm not entirely convinced we'll ever see that Tommy Bow again. I don't know the ins and outs and the intricacies of his injuries, but it's not really a huge surprise to me this season to not see him making the headlines. And yeah, as I say, I'm not entirely sure we'll ever see that Bow again. All right. Anyway, on that pretty grim point, let's have a quick recap of the Rugby Championship. So New Zealand won again, unbeaten Rugby Championship for the second consecutive competition. However, after an absolute spanking of South Africa in their last game, this was a fantastic contest. It was physical, it was brutal, there were great tries. South Africa really put up a fight and only just fell short.
Yeah, I mean, to lose by a point to New Zealand, you know, South Africa will be upset by that. But when you think, like you say, that they were beaten so badly last time they played, they'll perhaps take it. I think the performance of Marks at hooker has got to be a massive positive for them. Seem to find hookers very easily in South Africa. You know, they move on from Bismarck Du Plessis and they've got this guy coming through who's an absolute animal. In terms of New Zealand, you know, they are what they are. They've got skills to, you know, to die for. That Milner Scudder offload is going to be replayed over and over again. I mean, it was filthy, absolutely filthy. And Damian McKenzie, I mean, Ben Smith, who is, you know, just pace coming on from the back. He can kick, he can distribute, he can sit in at 12 when Barrett's out of the play. Yeah, it's, you just get annoyed with the way that New Zealand are just able just to pull these players out and just keep producing, and there doesn't seem to be too much drop off in their play at all.
Yeah, McKenzie is without a doubt one of my favourite players to watch in world rugby at the moment. He just astonishes me every time he gets the ball, it seems, and he's just absolutely glorious to watch. Although the scoreline was close, New Zealand blew a good few chances for tries, and there were a couple of TMOs, you know, correct decisions, but they blew a couple of tries. I think it is just more in the context of what happened in the last game, how impressive it was, and South Africa seemed to be able to get back to the South African, kind of the classic South Africa we know of. They were very, very good and dominant at set piece in the scrum. Eben Etzebeth, he scares me a little bit, to be honest, even when I know I'm sitting in the comfort of my own home and he just seems to glance at the camera and he's just frightening. And he got a bit of stick for his performance last week, but I struggle to think of many performances from a lock in terms of effort, work rate and ball carrying that were better than than the performance he put in against New Zealand. It was a monumental effort, and what a player. And there are definitely, I think, just given the state of the last result, South Africa, even though they'll be stinging that they lost, it was huge for them that they actually put in that performance and only lost by a point.
Oh yeah, I mean, and just to go back to what we were saying earlier about Edinburgh, they had 33% possession. New Zealand actually only had 36% of the ball in this game, and they made close to 80 more tackles than South Africa. But like you say, they actually could have won it by more. They miss some chances. And it's that thing, if they don't seem to mind defending, and when they get the ball, they know they've got people that can do special, special things with it. And the final point on this game is, what did you make of the red card?
Oh, I'm getting sick of talking about yellow and red cards, to be honest. I don't know, mate. What are you saying about it?
Well, I think it's difficult because in the Ulster Connacht game, there was something not the same but similar where Piatow chipped over the top and the guy jumped to charge it down and looked like he turned his hip into him and sort of hit him, and the ref just waved play on, no penalty. And then you talk about what happened in the Newcastle game where Cicchino got sin-binned for raising the elbow towards someone's face, and that was only a sin-bin. Whereas this one, I mean, yeah, his elbow sort of caught him on the chin a little bit, but I mean, you don't want to turn it into football where any graze of the face means that they're going to get a red card. I just thought it was a bit harsh. I think a yellow would have sufficed. I imagine if, you know, more of the weight that went into him to force him down was because he was charging him and his sort of hip and his body hit him and his elbow went near his face, if you like. I just thought it was very, very harsh.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's just back to the consistency thing, isn't it? That infuriates all of us, whether it's arms to the face or tip tackles or deliberate knock-ons. It's just infuriating. Sod it. Move on. Had enough of that, Andy. You've ended on a really negative point of what was a really good game.
I aim to please.
Right. So we're basically now at the exciting point where we can have a quick look ahead to the return of the Champions Cup. And I love Champions Cup. It does get me extremely excited and looking forward to the games. We've got some pretty tasty encounters. So shall we have a quick run through pool by pool? And we'll have a quick chat about the upcoming games and maybe who we think is going to progress in the group.
Let's go.
So pool one. We've got Ulster, Wasps, Harlequins, and the table toppers of the top 14 last year, even though they didn't win the final in the end, La Rochelle. So it does look like quite a tough group, and I'm starting to think that Wasps might become the whipping boys of that.
If they don't get anybody back, yeah. I mean, I think the five-day turnaround and going to Ulster, who are exceptionally good at home in Europe, I think probably only Saracens have been up there and taken anything recently. I expect Ulster to win that one, and it depends what French side turns up, as is always the case, as you always caveat when you see French teams. But La Rochelle were very good last year, and I saw a couple of their games, and they're fourth this season. They've played 7, won 5, lost 2. That's not a bad record at all. And if they turn up, they could well give Quins a hell of a game. And I think if they win that game, they may well attack this tournament and really, really go for it, because they've got Ulster at home next week. And if they can then get 2 wins out of 2, they'll be well set. Equally, the same happens with Quins. If Quins can beat La Rochelle and then go to what looks like a beleaguered Wasps the week afterwards and get the win, then Quins might start to think, actually, we might not be able to get out of this group. They might be thinking, actually, do you know what? We could well do this. And then again, it comes down to, if Wasps have been beaten in their first 2 games, do they then rest players for the rest of the tournament and you get a whipping boy in the group, and then you might get 2 teams out of this group. So I think these first 2 games are really going to decide what goes, I know it's obvious, but, you know, really going to decide the way that teams' attitudes are towards the tournament.
And what do you think is going to be the group winner?
I hate you. I can't trust the French, so I'm going to go Ulster.
Yeah, I'm going Ulster as well. And we'll do predictions as we roll through these previews. So for Ulster Wasps on Friday night, I'm picking Ulster bonus point win. What are you picking?
Just an Ulster win. I think Wasps might man up in defence.
Okay, and this is just, yeah, a nightmare. What are you predicting for Quins against La Rochelle?
Basically, because I'm a fan of the bookmakers, and I imagine that they don't get things wrong very often, and because the French tend to travel badly and Quins are good at home, Quins win.
No bonus points?
Nah, no bonus points.
I'm going to go for a La Rochelle win. I think they're going to turn up.
They are very good.
No bonus points for that either. Right, so pool two is, God, it's a tricky one to make out of it, but you've got Saris and Clermont, which is pretty brutal to have in the same group. Ospreys, who you may start to feel sorry for very quickly in this group, and Saints, so I'm not really sure whether, given their recent form, they might actually spring a few surprises or whether they'll get a few hammerings again.
yeah, again, it depends how they play it and how they get off to a good start. Franklin's Gardens for the first game, it's going to be tricky, but you'd expect Saracens to roll in there and do what Saracens do. I think Clermont are the one that might be in trouble in this group because they really haven't started the season well. They've only won three of their four games. I know they're missing a few people through injury, but I just wonder if, I mean, they might get a few people back later in the season. I think Fofana's injured, Nagatathi's injured. They need to get some of those players back, and it's whether or not they can hold on to enough points before they get them back to still be in the group. Because like we said earlier, if the French teams are out of it and they know they're not going to get through, they tend to just sack it off and concentrate on the top 14. So if they can get something, I mean, you'd expect them to get something out of the Ospreys and then get their game next week, which is at home to Northampton. If they can get something out of that, they might get some more players back, and then they get into the doubleheader with Saracens, which is going to be brutal. Then I imagine you might get two teams out of this group, mainly because I think the Ospreys are going to be beaten by everybody.
Yeah, I think Clermont are very lucky with how the fixtures have fallen. If you're going to have Ospreys as your away game and then Northampton as your first home game, given they are warming up to this season, I think it's very kind. That actually makes me lean towards, I think Clermont are going to top this group. I think they're going to top it ahead of Saracens. I think they're going to get a bonus point win against Ospreys just to kick it off. But I also see Sarries beating Saints at Franklin's Gardens.
I would... You can double those predictions. That was exactly what I was going to say. But I don't think Clermont will win the group. You can't bet against Sarries, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm not going to put money on it, Andy, but I am going to say it. Yeah. Right. So that was a bonus point for Clermont, wasn't it?
Yes, please.
Okay. Right. Pool three. So we've got Leinster. Oh, God. This group is, in terms of competition for all spots, what a fantastic group. Leinster, Montpellier, Exeter, Glasgow.
The thing is, my heart really wants to see Exeter and Glasgow go through because I think they're two teams that would really liven up the competition, play rugby the right way, and are really, really good. But then you look at the sort of heritage and the quality that Leinster have, and they just seem to be able to get through the groups. They weren't particularly good in the groups last year until sort of towards the end, and then they actually ended up in the semi-finals. And Montpellier, just a big French unit, and then you add in the fact that they've got Cruden playing at fly half, and they've got Nadolo on the wing, who just is an absolute inhumane player to try and tackle, and they could spring some surprises. And I'm quite pleased it's Leinster-Montpellier first, because I think if Leinster get that win, then Montpellier have got a home game the next week, against Exeter. If Exeter can go down there and perhaps cause a shock, then Montpellier will sack it off. And I really, really am. I think my favourite game this weekend is Exeter-Glasgow, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how that plays out.
It is. It's a great, great clash, isn't it? I mean, I think both the games in this group are just brilliant. But then, until maybe if there is a side that falls away as the weeks go on, I'm struggling to see a weekend where I'm not looking forward to any of the fixtures in this group. I think it is the most evenly matched. It is very tight. I would like to see Exeter or Glasgow do pretty well, but I just have a feeling that maybe experience and depth, I quite fancy Leinster to top it.
I fancy Exeter to win it. I think they're going to go all out for the Champions Cup this year. And yeah. I really, really think they'll top it. But the other thing I think with having four such good teams is it'll be one of the pools where you only get one team out, which is a bit upsetting because you'd like to see one of Glasgow or Leinster go through as well, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Right, predictions for the weekend games, though. I'm thinking an extra win at Sandy Park, but no try bonus point. And I'm going to go for a Munster win with no try bonus point. Oh, I've gone into the next group. Sorry, mate. Sorry, a Leinster bonus point win at home and then an Exeter win at home with no bonus point.
I'll go a Leinster win, no bonus point.
Yeah.
I'd really like to see the weather because I think if it's a nice day in Exeter, I think both of those teams are going to play some really nice stuff. And I think you could see perhaps try bonus points for both. But I'll go an Exeter win. Oh, it's so difficult in Europe because they don't tend to be as many tries. No, I'll go X to win, no bonus point.
Okay. As you may have guessed from my slight slip up there, Castra and Munster are in the next pool, along with Toulon and Scarlets. So this is another pretty tough group. There's a lot of what looks like tough groups this
year,
aren't
there? Hang on. Castro and Munster are with Tigers and Racing.
Sorry, I was looking at the fixtures instead of the pools. You have my sincerest apologies. So pool four, Racing, Leicester, Castro and Munster. So what do you make of that lot?
Well, Racing, again, poor start to the season. Dan Carter's injured. They've only won three of their first seven games. They're eighth in the top 14. Castro are worse. They've only won two of their first seven games, 11th in the top 14. There's a real chance that if Leicester and Munster can go big this first week, you know, if Leicester can go to Paris and win, Munster can put a good bonus point win away in Castro, or go to Castro and win, that then next week, both of those teams are at home. They do the double again. Leicester beat Castro, Munster beat Racing. Then the French teams might sack it off, and you could well see Leicester and Munster progressing from this group. But it all, I think, hangs on this first weekend. If they can both go away and win against two struggling French teams, which they've definitely both got the capability of doing, and the way they're playing, I think they could do it, then it'll be a good old-school Tigers-Munster shootout.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a classic game, doesn't it, Leicester and Munster? It's really tough, though, given you would expect the French sides to put up a fight, particularly at home and in the first week. But neither of them are in particularly good form at the moment either. But then I wouldn't necessarily say Munster or Leicester are in good enough form to say with any confidence you quite fancy them to go away and win. So very, very tough games to pick. But I think I'm gonna go for a Munster away win and a Racing home win.
I'm gonna go with my heart, two away wins.
Okay, and who to come out of the group as winner, pool winner?
I'm going to go with what I said originally, Leicester and Munster both to go through.
Who do you think will top it?
I didn't say that because I didn't want
to. Yeah, I'm making you.
just because you're a Munster fan, right? It's the only time you've made me pick a winner.
I've made you pick a winner in every pod for anything. Right, I did tell you I would only stick it on the fence.
Tigers, said with all the confidence in the world.
All right, Tigers for you. So that leaves us with pool five. So we have got Bath, Benetton Treviso, Toulon and Scarlets.
I really, really, really hope the Scarlets can take their Pro 14 form into Europe and win this group, because I think it would be great for the Pro 14 to get a Welsh side going well. It'd be great for Welsh rugby to get a Welsh side going far in this tournament. And Toulon aren't the team they were. They're still a very good side. They've still got five wins out of their first seven games and a second in the top 14. But I think there's not that fear factor about them anymore. I don't think the Scarlet... I think, again, because there's a Italian team in this group, you'll get two teams coming through without any shadow of a doubt, because I'd imagine Scarlets and Toulon and Bath will all be targeting 10 points from those games. I know Treviso have improved, but they're not that improved. And then it will come down to the games in the middle, which I think are where Bath get Toulon. Bath get the double header with Toulon. So if Scarlets, like I say, even with that 5-day turnaround, I think if they can get a bonus point win against Bath and perhaps a losing bonus point in Toulon, then pick up their 10 points against Treviso to sit on 16 points after four games, they can then target those last two games, and it might end up with them having to go to the rec in the final game, perhaps just needing a couple of points to top the group. And I really hope they can do it, but I'm all of my heart still can't see the past that Toulon are just going to grind the free play of Scarlets down and probably end up winning the group.
So you reckon Toulon to win the group? I'm going to go with Bath.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going for it. And I'm going to go with a Bath bonus point win against Treviso, and I'm going to go with a Scarlets win away at Toulon.
Well, you've got no faith in Toulon. So,
well, I just think that, as you say, they're not the side they used to be. Even when they were, Scarlets have actually done okay against them in the last few years anyway when they played them and got a draw. And maybe probably should have won that game. But I just think that even Toulon, they look like they've won a few games. But if you look at the teams they've beaten and even the games they've had at home, they're against sides much lower down in the French league and they've only won by a handful of points. And I know that's what they can be good at, but I just got a bit of a feeling that Scarlets will carry that over and do them.
Yeah, I'd go for a... Oh, I really want to say the Scarlets win, but I'm going to go for a Toulon win, Bath bonus point win.
Okay. We've got a few different ones mixed up here, Andy, so there'll certainly be some interesting discussions when we look at the predictions for this.
Indeed.
Right. So, is that it? Is that all of our pools?
We're done.
We are. We are done indeed. So, the only thing left to do, I suppose, is go through the results of our predictions last week. We've managed to take one apiece, Andy, so... I just by the skin of my teeth outdid you on the Premiership, which very much owed to me predicting the losing bonus point for London Irish against Leicester. That nicked it for me. But then predicting with your heart instead of your head can sometimes be your downfall, as was the case in the Pro 14 when I got a bit carried away and predicted an away win for Munster at Leinster, which you completely didn't, which meant you won 21-16 on that. So... You took an overall aggregate points win, but I shaded the Prem and you took the Pro 14, Mr. Wenborn.
I'll take that.
Right, well, we'll get those totted up for next week. That's all we've got for this week's pod. So we'll be back with you next week, slightly earlier than this. Make sure that you check out lastwordonrugby.com, who we are brought to you by. Obviously, we are the highlight of lastwordonrugby.com. But there are also many other brilliant articles, match reports, opinion pieces. So get yourself on there and check it out. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.